Good afternoon, everyone. This is Danny Haifong. You are tuning into another Left Lens live stream, and I have a very special guest today. So while you are coming into the stream, make sure you're hitting that like button. Make sure that you are hitting that subscription button. Make sure that you're hitting the notifications bell, sharing this stream around. But we're going to get right to it. So today I have the pleasure of introducing Richard Wolf, an economist, the founder of Democracy at Work and the podcast Economic Update. He's currently a professor at the New School. He is a profound Marxist economist, and I've been following his work for a long time. Hi, Richard. How are you doing today?
Pretty well, Danny. Thank you. Very nice introduction. I'm much obliged.
Yes. Well, I really appreciate you taking the time out today to talk about something that I think is on the minds of many working people, working class people across this country, across the planet, and that is this breakneck inflation that's been happening. Workers across this country and around the world are really suffering from the rise in these prices. It's been going on now for what seems like months now, and with no end in sight. And yesterday, I was doing a stream on my own, and I found a Business Insider article where the purported journalist was speaking to Wall Street investors. And perhaps this is also going around in other mainstream publications. They were suggesting, these Wall Street investors, that the only way to fix inflation at this moment, what they call a wage price spiral, is to have the Federal Reserve institute an economic crisis, create a recession. I want to get your reaction to that. And if you could just help us understand, one, what's causing this? Two, also, if you could talk about the mechanics of capitalism here, because this is not what Business Insider really likes to do, even if they tell you what Wall Street investors are thinking in their head. They're not telling us how capitalism actually works. So if you would oblige us.
Absolutely. And thank you for the opportunity. I do appreciate it. Let me start out by giving everyone a bit of a warning. I've been an economics professor all my life. That's quite a few years now. And so I've been around. And I will tell you this, that the level of disconnect between what the Wall Street Journal or other major newspapers are saying, what our political leaders are saying, and what the actual reality is, I've never seen it as badly disconnected or misconnected as is going on now. And let me give you a couple of examples. The Biden administration and many others like to say over and over again, that the inflation is not just an American problem, you know. It's all over the world. That's false. Let me give you an example. The United States currently, legally, officially, admits to a rate of inflation across the board of about 8.5, between 8.5 and 9%. And you do get numbers like that in Britain and so forth. But let me make clear to you, I'm going to pick two other countries that everybody's heard of. One is called Japan, and one is called the People's Republic of China. They currently have inflation rates of 1%, not 8%, not 9%, not half of that, not a quarter of that, nothing by comparison. So the notion that we are all together in this may be comforting to the people who are talking out of their mouths, but it isn't true, and it hasn't been true, and it ought to be faced up to that. It's a little bit like COVID, where we have the United States with 1 million people dead, the People's Republic of China, a country four times larger than the United States, with 20,000 people dead. That's not close. That has to be confronted. That's a statistic of staggering proportions. And I could have picked other countries too, not just China, and made the same point. So that's the first thing. Now the second thing that you point to, quite right. everybody seems agreed, Republicans and Democrats, Biden, Trump, and all the others, that the inflation is bad and that the way to stop it or bring it down is to raise interest rates. And the idea is simple. If you raise interest rates, you make it more expensive for people to borrow. We won't borrow to buy a car quite so easily because the monthly payments will go up if interest rates do. Ditto for buying a house or an apartment. Ditto for using credit cards. You're all going to learn, if you haven't already, that at the end of the month with a higher credit card interest rate, which, by the way, is currently averaging 20% per year, you're going to pay more to carry your credit over time. So it hurts borrowers, people who are already in debt, people who are facing more debts. That's what it does. And the hope is, here we go now, the hope is that there'll be so many fewer car buyers, so many fewer home buyers, so many fewer credit card uses that companies will be less likely to raise their prices because they're already having trouble holding on to their customer. And so we'll bring the inflation down, the theory goes, by really whacking the population with an inflation. And before I go on, let me drive home. We've just put the American people through an experience that has no precedent in American history. The years 2020 and 2021, we had the worst public health disaster in our country's history, happening at a time when we had the second worst economic crash in our country's history, both at the same time. We've never had that before. People really suffered. A million people died. Many millions got very ill. Some of them will have symptoms. We don't even know how long they'll last. You know, on and on and on. To put a population through that is bad. But to follow it up with an inflation, I mean, that's unspeakable. The only thing worse than that would be to follow up the inflation by a recession, which is precisely what raising all these interest rates risks having happen. And now here comes another disconnect. The Republicans and the Democrats are alike in behaving and talking and giving speeches as if this were the only way to deal with an inflation. That's straight out wrong. It's so wrong that I'm now going to give you two quick examples from American history. By that, I mean the history of the U.S. I know we shouldn't say America. There's much more to America than the U.S. But I'll take them from U.S. history. I'll take one from a Republican conservative president and one from a progressive Democrat. They all had to handle inflations too. Let's see how they did it real quick. August 15th, 1971, then President Richard Nixon, conservative Republican. He goes on the radio and the TV and he says, as of tomorrow morning, my fellow Americans, if you're a business and you raise prices, we will arrest you and throw you in jail. So my advice is, don't do it. If you're a worker or a union, if you push wages up, we will arrest you and throw you in the clink too. In other words, he declared what came to be known as a price wage freeze. By the way, there's a whole literature. I could get you books about wage price freezes. You know why? Because countries around the world, not just the United States, have used them. And guess what? They work. Do they have problems associated with them? Of course, all these kinds of policies do. Raising interest rates certainly does. But that's not relevant. In the 9 months that came after August 15th, 1971, we stopped the inflation on a dime. There was no inflation. So don't let anyone tell you raising interest rates is the only thing we can do. That's just wrong. Mr. Nixon, a conservative, did it. Let me give you the second example. It's early in the 1940s. The United States has entered World War II and is now a key player in a war against Germany, Italy, and Japan, the major other side of that war. And economic advisors come to the then progressive Democratic president, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and they say to him, look, President Roosevelt, we got a big problem. We're the economists. We got to tell you about it. We are shifting resources from producing consumer goods to producing munitions for war. We have to, because we can't risk losing the war. Okay, so we are going to move railroad cars and factories and land and roadways and trucking fleets to be used for munitions, making them and getting them overseas and all the rest. And that means the supply, here we go now, the supply of consumer goods is going to be shrunken and fast. This is a matter of a few months. You got to act, Mr. President, because within a few months, things are going to dry up in the supermarket shelf or in the department store shelf. And you know what happens then, Mr. President? They said to him, here's what happened. Rich people will come in. They'll see, like everybody else does, that the shelves getting empty, and they'll go to the manager and they'll say, look, I'll give you twice whatever the price of that thing is because I want to make sure I get it. In other words, we'll bid up the prices as the wealthy act in the market the way markets are set up as an institution. People don't like to hear it because they want to deal with markets as though they deserve religious support. But markets are a way of allocating scarce items to the richest amongst us, violating every ethical norm of every religion I've ever heard of, which would never do that. And the advisors to Roosevelt said to him, if you don't step in, you're going to see rich people go to the store, bid up the price of milk, take it home and feed it to their cat while the family with six little kids can't get the milk they need to grow up. And you know what you're going to have? A bitter, angry society, which is the worst possible way to go into a war. You need your people unified. You need your people supporting each other. You need your people feeling solidarity so that they can get behind the war effort and all of that. So you allow markets to work. You allow this inflation to happen. You will risk losing the war. Roosevelt didn't need any more smart guy. He said to them, okay, that's it. What do I do? And their answer was, first thing, get rid of the market. We can't have a market. We can't let rich people get what's scarce. This is self-destructive of a society. So here's what they did. They printed up what were called ration books or ration books. Inside each book, there were little ration stamps. And you tore off the stamp. And each stamp gave you, for example, an entitlement for a pound of sugar or a gallon of gas for your car or whatever it was, lots of things. And the way the law worked was if you went to the store and all you had was money, the storekeeper could not give you the stuff. You could only buy it if you had a ration card, a ration stamp entitling you to buy it. And the government handed out ration stamps. And you know how they did it? They gave people what they thought, oh boy, here it comes, they needed. If you had a family with a lot of children, you got a lot of milk stamps. If you had a family with no children, you got fewer milk stamps. If you were rural and had a truck, you got more stamps for gas than if you were urban and could rely on mass public transportation, etc. Logical, intelligent ways of dealing with this problem. And guess what? We didn't have an inflation in the 1940s. So anyone, again, who tells you the only thing we can do about this is to raise interest rates, You're listening to somebody who's either ignorant or is not your friend and telling you stuff that is noisy nonsense. It never was, and it isn't now. We ought to be having, we're not, but we ought to be having in our society a debate about raising interest rates, about rationing, about wage price freezes, and there are other mechanisms that have been used. And we ought to explain to the American people, here's the benefits and costs of each of these. Here's the strength and weakness. And then let's have, can we dare say it, a democratic decision about how we're not doing that. We are taking care of business. And let me end this by making clear why we're taking care of business. And here, this is the simplest economics there is. And people already know it, but they got to put it together a little bit better than they have. And they're not getting any help from mainstream media, which is the politest way I can say that. Okay, who sets prices? You know, inflation is when prices rise. So the first logical question that a five-year-old would ask is, okay, I understand. Inflation, the prices go up. Who determines prices? Well, let me answer the question. Employers. All of us who have been employees all of our life probably noticed that no employer ever asked us to participate in the process of deciding how much to charge for whatever it is we help to produce. That's not our job. It's not in the job description of the employee. The employers keep that powerful right, that powerful function to themselves. Well, what percentage of our population are employers? Not even 1%. Which means that an inflation is something 1% of the people do and the other 99% live with. That's the way we do it. Doesn't have to be that way. We could have a democratic procedure to set prices. I would believe in it because I take democracy seriously. We don't have that in our society because, if truth be told, we don't. So we allow a tiny minority. That's why we have an inflation. A tiny minority raised the prices. Government doesn't do that. Labor unions don't do that. Corporations raise the prices of goods. And now the final point. Why do the employers raise the prices? And the answer is what you learn if you're an employer and you go to a place called a business school. I have taught in business schools. You teach young people in a business school that they are driven by profit maximization. When you ask a question, do I expand my business? Do I hire more people? Do I buy a fleet of trucks? Do I move production from here to Mexico? Whatever. The answer is supposed to be, well, how will doing that affect your bottom line, i.e. your profits? If it'll be good for profits, probably should do it. If it's bad for profits, you probably should say no. And that's developed. Okay, so here we go. If businesses across the board raised their prices over the last 12 months, which we know they did, and then the answer is they did it, ready? Because it was good for their profits to do that. And of course, being Americans, they don't want to take responsibility for what they just did to make more profits. So like all good employers, they like to have scapegoats, someone else to blame. So I didn't raise the price for me. Oh, no. I had to, you see. Well, why did you have to? Well, let me see. Ukraine. Huh? Ukraine got nothing to do with it. Here's even more magical thinking. Supply chain disruptions. Oh my God. For this, you don't have to pardon me. You know, at some point you stop taking this nonsense seriously and you start laughing. I won't be disrespectful of your audience and start laughing. But let me just remind everyone. every business ever developed has a supply chain, because a business takes inputs and transforms them into outputs. So, for example, you buy lumber and you transform it into a chair, or you buy cotton and you make it into a shirt. So cotton is the input and lumber is the input, and you got to get it from where it's made to your workplace so you can make your production. That's called a supply chain of your input. And you don't care whether it comes 6 miles away or 6,000 miles away. You just got to make sure it's there in the right time, in the right quantity, in the right quality, the right price. And you know what? Every medium to large business has in it something called the purchasing department. And the job of the purchasing manager is, here we go, to manage the supply chain, to have inventory in case it gets disrupted, to have a plan B if plan A doesn't work, a fallback supplier if your major supplier can't deliver on. The notion that suddenly all of the purchasing managers couldn't do their job, it's so lousy nonsense that the only really interesting thing is where did the people who run this society find enough media folks to repeat this noise as if it were the fountain of wisdom? It isn't. The last 2 years were difficult for most American capitalists. They wanted to make up the profits they didn't get in 2020 and 2021. And the fastest, easiest way to boost, recompensate themselves, recoup the profits they didn't get, was by jacking up the prices right now. And that's why they did it. And that's why we have it. And if we don't go after them, identifying who raised the price, why they raised them, and deal with that, then we are going to do all these other things. We are living, by the way, in an economic system that is now going nuts. It couldn't handle the COVID. It couldn't handle the crash. It wasn't ready for either of them. Now it can't handle the inflation, and now we're going to have a recession. Come on, how many of these crazy moves do you begin to need to see before you recognize this is a system that doesn't work?
Yeah, no, I mean, you said so much there, and there's so much I would like to follow up on. What it feels like, though, and you, what you said, that the capitalists, the employers, they are looking to recoup their profits. I feel like when I've said that, you get this rebuke, even among people who tend to think of themselves as understanding economics and understanding even just the inequality, the injustice of the capitalist system. There's this rebuke because there are all these factors that we've been told. And I think part of this is just literally propaganda. The mainstream media has so many reasons, right? We've heard so many things from China's COVID-19 response as being responsible. We've heard Ukraine as being responsible, the Russia-Ukraine conflict. We've heard so many reasons for why this is happening, but none of them have been, well, capitalists want to make more money when there's opportunities to do so. And now I want to ask you about the crisis, right? The crisis that will be generated if investors in Wall Street get what they want. In 2020, during the COVID-19 pandemic, there was an economic crisis. There was a recession. Yep. And the banks, the investors, they all got bailed out. They received a huge upward transfer of wealth and money.
Yep.
Is that what they're calculating upon now? Is that why they're pushing this particular policy? Because it seems like what you're suggesting is, if there was government intervention, if there was some kind of intervention into the economy to stabilize things, it could be stabilized quite easily. But that's not happening. Why would Wall Street investors, why would these robber barons, so to speak, why would they want to tank the economy? Because that doesn't sound great, but they're vocalizing it. They're literally vocalizing it to the public.
That's because they have learned over time that things like an inflation, if they are allowed to go on, can cripple an economy. They wish they didn't have to intervene. They don't like to have the government step in. But they're doing it because the alternative is worse. Look, that's the way it was in the 1930s. The only reason we had the New Deal, and I don't mean to take away from Franklin Roosevelt or from the CIO, the labor movement, or the socialist and communist parties at that time who were strong in the United States and who pushed hard for the New Deal. I don't want to take away what they did. We wouldn't have had it without them. But they got the approval, otherwise we couldn't have had it, of the capitalists, the leading ones in this country. And remember, Franklin Roosevelt, the president, comes from that part of it. He is part of the employer class. He was then. His family had other presidents earlier before him. So he was absolutely of that. But that community supported it because they were fearful that if they didn't do this thing they didn't like, they would have something happen to them that they would not like even more. And I'll tell you what it was then, and I'll tell you what it is now. Then it was revolution. Remember, 1929 is only 12 years after 1917, when you had the Russian Revolution, and for the first time, a socialist government and society. And capitalists everywhere were afraid that that could come to their doorstep. And when the stock market and the economies of the capitalist West collapsed, all of them, in 1929, those simple 12 years later, that's what they were afraid of. And they were told by the AFL-CIO, in those days it was just the CIO, and they were told by the people in the streets, you better do something to fix this capitalism or else you're going to see a revolution here. And that's what frightened them. And so they went along with Roosevelt's creating Social Security, unemployment compensation, a vast program of government hired jobs, the first minimum wage we ever had as a nation. All of those things that capitalists have always fought before and since were given almost easily at that time because so many capitalists were afraid of worse. Well, what is it today? Same thing. But what's the worst now? I'll give you some examples. This inflation coming after these terrible 2 years is really agitating the American working class. For the moment, their agitation is moving them to the political right, to Trump and all of that. White supremacy, abortion struggles that are in the news, obviously, these days, and so on. And so as far as long as that lasts, then the people at the top don't mind sticking it to the working class. And remember, just to understand, prices are going up 8.5% a year. Wages are going up half of that, which means every worker is falling behind. So they're worried in case the anger of the mass of people is being stoked, that worries them a little. If it could go to the left, then they'd worry a lot. Mm. Oh, if Bernie or AOC or any of those kinds of folks, let alone those that are further to the left, if that begins to be where the anger goes, then they've got to stop that inflation right away. And they don't care what the government needs to, all those views about the appropriate government, that's all gone. Save us becomes the only issue. And let me tell you why they are worried now more than ever. 2 weeks ago, there was an election in France. Most Americans don't know and don't care. Big mistake. The French left is fractured, broken into lots of little, like the American left. But they did something remarkable under their current leader, whose name should be known in America, so I'll mention it, Jean-Luc Mélenchon. He unified the whole left wing. He got them all together. And to create one party for these elections they had a couple of weekends ago. It includes the French Communist Party, the French Socialist Party, the French Green Party, and a bunch of others. They got a third of the vote in France 2 weeks ago. And Mr. Mélenchon is much to the left of Bernie Sanders. So, whoa. Now everyone in France, I mean, I read French. My father was born in France. I pay attention to the country. The whole capitalist class in France is completely, they don't know what to do. And the left in France, euphoric. They discovered, by the way, there is a right wing in France, a woman named Marine Le Pen, all right? In the elections 2 Sundays ago, the left wing Mélenchon got 31.6% of the vote. She, the right winger, she got 17%. American newspapers, she grew so much. That wasn't the important result. The important result is that the unified left got almost twice the vote she did. And that's the reality of French politics. Whoa. Everything is changing in France right now as we speak. The right wing doesn't believe in the war in Iraq, and the left wing doesn't either. The sitting president, he got 38% of the vote. So the overwhelming majority, two-thirds of the people who went to vote, don't want the president they elected 2 weeks ago. So you have to understand everything is very fluid. So more and more people are saying we've got to stop this inflation, even if it throws 5 to 10 million people out of work, which it will.
Yeah.
Now, if you're the thinker, if you and I are analysts of this situation, then here's the real question, which no media dares to raise, that in Wall Street and in the corridors of power, all that's being asked is, which is more dangerous for the survival of capitalism? Letting the inflation go or causing a recession as the way to solve the inflation? That's the real question. And that's going to be decided partly by the elections that come here in November, partly by whatever happens between now and then, and partly what the inflation itself does. Remember, if there's an inflation here, it means that the goods anybody else in the world buys from America become more expensive. That's what an inflation is, which means our exports will be hurt. People everywhere will be looking for the less inflated alternative. And since I told you that Japan and China, among other countries, have no inflation, this is great for them. More and more of the world will buy Chinese goods that aren't going up instead of all of that is shaking up. But, you know, we're living in an economic system that is in very deep doo-doo. That's why we have the problems we do, and we have solutions that strike a lot of people as possibly worse than the problem they're designed to solve. That's not because the politician is stupid. It's because the problems have accumulated to the point where nobody knows what to do.
Yeah. Well, I think this is a good time to segue to geopolitics. Before I do that, I would like to remind people to make sure that they're liking this stream and sharing it, helping spread this message around, helping sustain this work, patreon.com/DannyHaiFong. But I want to get into now, I think this is a good segue because you brought up France and you brought up China and Japan and kind of the political situation around the world. You know, what I noticed about the United States, because the United States is in the deepest of doo-doo, it seems like, but I mean, Europe is kind of just tagging right along, and when it comes to the Russia situation, it seems like Europe, the EU, is willing to do many times more damage than even the United States is willing to do in relation to this conflict, the Russia-Ukraine conflict. But I want to ask, you know, what is the link here? Because the United States right now, you know, the G7 type of NATO summit's about to happen, G7 met. Their focus is overwhelmingly on escalating the conflict in Ukraine, the Russia-Ukraine conflict, and escalating with China. There's a hyper-intensive focus led by the United States. But it would seem that this is kind of contradictory to everything that you've been saying about how do we address this inflation crisis? how do we do something other than putting the economy, the world capitalist economy in the tank into a recession? What is the link here? Because it seems like the more dire the economic situation becomes for the U.S. and its partners, its junior partners, the more aggressive they become in regards to Russia and to China. What's the link here? Why is that occurring at the same time, in your opinion?
Well, you know, this is the kind of conversation a proper media would have. Very good question, right one to ask, logical. And I'm going to give you the answer, but before I do, I want to really talk about that it's wonderful that you're doing this, but it is terribly sad at how rare people it is to find people thinking clearly about it. All right, let me start with the European end of your story. Europe is in a very difficult place. It is caught as a part of the world whose empires have all disappeared, the British, the Spanish, the Dutch, the Portuguese, the French, a little bit the Germans for the short time they had one, etc. So they're coming down from their dominant role in the history of the world from the 17th, 18th, 19th century. Been very hard for them, number one. Number two, they've been outflanked, particularly in the last half century, by the growth to dominance of the United States on the one hand, and now in the last three decades, the growth of the People's Republic of China on the other. And there's really no place for them. They can't compete with the United States for all kinds of historical reasons, and they can't with the Chinese because basically nobody can. The Chinese have figured out something that the world is going to have to slowly learn, doesn't want to learn, but that this mixture that Xi Jinping and the others have figured out, the mixture between private capitalist enterprises, which there are many, many of in China, and state enterprises owned and operated by the government. This is not what the Soviet Union did. This is not Scandinavia. It is a kind of socialism, but it has large admixtures of capitalism. And managing all of this to be able to show the economic growth that they have experienced in the last 40 years means that the Europeans have been completely outflanked. And that means they don't know quite what to do. Part of them, and this was very strong for a while, part of them began to say, maybe we better make a deal with China. Maybe we better understand that the American economy is over and the Chinese economy is in the ascendant. Most people around the world see that, even Americans, until the Europeans were but that frightened the Americans. They needed something to prevent the Europeans from following the logic and if not siding with China necessarily, but cutting lots of deals, which the Chinese were eager to do. The biggest port in Greece is owned by Chinese interests. The German manufacturing economy, the strongest in Europe, is completely wrapped up with the Chinese economy, dependent on them, et cetera, et cetera. The United States needed to make sure that the Europeans didn't keep going where the logic of capitalism's development said they ought to go. And so they needed things to happen, here we go now, that might make it at least harder, that might harder for the Europeans to go towards the Chinese. And the Ukraine situation provided the Americans with an opportunity they saw, and they were determined to do it. They have been pushing NATO further east, whether you're talking Poland in the north or the Czech Republic in the middle or Romania and Bulgaria in the south. This Ukraine is only the latest step, Finland, Sweden, and so on. They're trying to mobilize the right wing, center right of Europe, to be the stalwart ally of the United States in a confrontation economically, politically, culturally with China. And they understood that Russia is allied with China. Their chance to separate Russia, which might have happened after 1989, they missed that. That, by the way, they could have had that. That was, put that aside, that's a failure of American foreign policy. So Ukraine is perfect. Ukraine, you can mobilize everybody to the right of the center right in Europe will get excited about that. Why? Because it distracts the people of those countries from the economic problems they have and that Europe cannot solve. All the high tech in the world, I mean, with a few exceptions, but high tech is either American or it's Chinese. The rest of it doesn't count. You know, the production that's going on, the growth, the expansion, it's all Russia, it's all China and the United States, if there's any in the United States. But there is, I mean, who here, the Europeans can't, and partly because they can't get together. If they all got together, then they'd be a bigger economic unit than the United States or China. But they don't. They continue in their crazy failure to break out of medieval Europe. They can't do it. So this war is a way, solves two problems. It helps the United States make an alliance, slow the process of China, and it gives European leaders a distraction for their people from their own suffering. But you know, that stuff never lasts very long. And the terrible anxiety in Europe and here among people who know, and there are those people, is that time is running out. They don't know how much longer their people will tolerate governments that are busy sending billions into who knows what in Ukraine, as opposed to solving their urgent economic problems. This is, you know, when the hoopla about joining NATO, when all of that, because there is, I mean, NATO is not a real thing anyway. When that passes, when the hype around Ukraine is over, what are they going to be left with? Less money than they had before, a totally ruined Ukraine. I mean, look what's happening here on the ground in Ukraine is awful. And the malarkey, the talk about disconnect again, the nonsense talked about in the West as to what this is costing Russia. I mean, it's downright funny. It is so completely wrong and wrong-headed that it's no longer, I mean, I can refute it if you want, but the more interesting question is, Americans are smart people. Americans need to know what's going on. What are they doing? You know, why? I give you an example. Yesterday, with great fanfare, Secretary of State Blinken made a speech. We are banning the import of Russian gold, he said. Okay, banning Russian gold. If you know anything about economics, that is so silly, it takes your breath away. You know why? Because gold can be melted. Then you don't know where it's from. You know, I mean, this is silly. You can't do that. Anyway, American press, I remember the first time I saw it, it's a Yahoo Finance story, big pushed by Yahoo. How heavy the impact will be on Russia, and they can't export their gold. Russia, by the way, is one of the world's great gold producers, so it's important to their economy. Then, literally 2 hours later, in Reuters, the British news agency, there's a story. And the story says the banning of Russian gold imports will not have any effect on Russia. It's just a symbolic move. Now, in most cases, you don't get the kind of Reuters story. But I love this example because within an hour or two, you had the American Secretary of State looking like the faker that he was in that moment. I don't know him. Maybe he's wonderful everywhere else. But in that moment, he's just talking junk. He's talking what he thinks will play well in the political life. And the fact that it's stone cold, silly, wrong doesn't worry him. Reuters doing something they don't often do, but they are the biggest, you know, news agency in Britain and in many parts of the world. They look at this, give it to an analyst who says, this is not going to make any difference at all. I mean, most of the sanctions against Russia have been, by the way, like that. They've been all ceremony, like the G7 that you're seeing tonight on TV. It's all ceremony. It's all shirt sleeves and we're doing nothing. And on the battlefield, Russia keeps winning. Ukraine keeps retreating. I mean, people, I'm telling you, they will look back on this, not only with the horror of all the people who suffered and died in the Ukraine, for which we can only feel terrible, but to wonder, how did this country and European allies, how did they self-delude on this scale for this long? I mean, you know, Ukraine is on the border of Russia. The United States is having to ship 8,000 miles missiles so that a little country can do something to defend itself against. It's crazy. Let me give you a statistic and just ask everyone watching. If you don't know what I'm about to tell you, if you didn't know, and it is crucial to understanding what's going on, ask yourself why you didn't know. Here we go. Economists use a number called the GDP, gross domestic product, as a rough measure of how big and strong an economy is, because the GDP tells you the total value of goods and services produced in a year in that country. Every country has a GDP. The UN and other agencies keep track. Okay, the GDP of Russia, our great enemy. Ready? Ready? Here we go. $1.5 trillion. The GDP of the United States, $21 trillion. Okay? This is not a fight between equals. This is not a struggle between equals. This is a struggle between David and Goliath, and I won't upset anyone by telling you who's playing which role. That the Russians would go to war with the risk of the United States means either they're crazy, and there's not one shred of evidence to suggest it, or they know exactly what they're doing. They know they can do it. They know how far they can go. The United States doesn't know what it can do, so it is hysterically, you know, gesturing. But it can't. It can't. You know, we lost the war in Vietnam. We lost the war in Iraq. We lost the war in Afghanistan. And we're going to lose this one, too. And, yeah. It keeps being unthinkable for most Americans to get their heads around this. And all I can say is you should have taken a page from the British. Their empire has been going down for a century. You might learn from that, that you better make some accommodations. The British tried to squash the Americans in the Revolutionary War, in the end of the 18th century, and then again in the War of 1812. When they were defeated twice, they gave up. The United States doesn't seem to be able to learn.
Yeah, you know. And this is all very interesting, given that the world capitalist economy is heading toward recession, along with the problems with, as you said, these ceremonious sanctions. But the U.S. does expect Europe to do what it says. And so that leads to a very, very, I think, major problem, especially for Europe. But it's going to ripple across the world, in the United States in particular, the fact that you would have an energy crisis due to sanctions and then an economic crisis at the same time. And you also have Russia, which is doing what it needs to do to maintain some semblance of stability, given that it is the subject of all of these economic attacks. it is, as you said, this picture of like this flailing. It's like the U.S. is a flailing fish out of water, and it's trying to create a it's trying to create a permanent war situation in a particular moment where no such thing can lead to anything good. But I want to just get your final reactions. Anything you'd want to finish up here as we approach the hour?
Yeah, a couple of things that just flesh out the other image. The Russians either knew or have been beyond words lucky. Just to be clear to everybody, the increase in the price of oil and gas, which are major exports of Russia, mean, try to get your head around this, that Russia has earned more in export revenue from selling oil and gas at a higher price. They've earned more there than the war in Iraq has cost them. Therefore, it's a free war. Countries very rarely have that. Nothing is happening in the United States to make the war in Ukraine cheaper or free or anything like that. That's one thing. Number two, Russia can export limitless amounts of oil and gas to the rest of the world, not just China and India, who are taking huge quantities of it, but the whole rest of the world. Why? Because after Europe and Japan and the United States, most of the rest of the world doesn't care about the Ukraine war or sides with Russia or refuses to side with either side, but continues to trade with Russia and China. And all you're going to be seeing, and you see it already, are more and more unifying cooperation agreements among the Indians, the Chinese, and all of the others as an alternative to the dominance of the world of the United States and Europe, which means that the latter is going to go further down and you're seeing a flailing fish out of water, but that fish is actually making its own pond murkier and its own future more difficult. And you have to wonder whether the internal craziness of this country, what the Supreme Court is doing and all, isn't also linked in to a society that is desperately trying to find something, you know, to bring it back. No wonder Mr. Trump wants to make America great again. I mean, because look where it's going.
Yes, yes, indeed. Well, Professor Wolf, it was so good to have you. I will be sticking around, everyone, for about another 20 minutes, half an hour. But I just want to say, Professor Wolf, this was great. I hope we can keep in touch. And any plug for where people can find you?
Easiest thing to do is to go to www.democracyatwork.info. So democracyatwork.info. Everything we do is accessible through that website.
Great. Well, thanks so much again, and we will have to do this again sometime. Take good care.
Absolutely, and thank you for having a program that is willing and able to put this stuff out.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye. So that was Rick Wolf. We are still going to continue to stream, so do not go anywhere. I'm going to be on probably till about 5:25, 5:30. No call-in today, guys. I got to pick up my dog. I don't have the time to do it. I have to figure out a few things. So I'm not able to do a call in tonight, but I will stay on here for another half hour with all of you. Please do like the stream though. You guys, you know, the likes are kind of lagging behind the views here. So whoever is watching this, please do like the stream. I think we're about 50 likes short. So if we can get another 50 likes on the stream, that would be great. That wasn't a great, it was one of the better conversations I've had in a while. So I definitely have to give Richard Wolf all of his props. I mean, just the ability to both hit on the economic and the intellectual side of the analysis, as well as to present it in a very digestible way. I mean, that is that is really the name of this game that we call struggle, that we call politics and political struggle. So I really enjoyed that conversation. And I think, you know, I hope all of you got a lot from it. But with that said, not just liking the stream and sharing it, but also please do. I'm only $21 per month from my goal for the year on Patreon. I want to stop asking. I hate asking. Somebody commented on a YouTube video, you know, stop begging. But that, unfortunately, putting out the promotion, all of that is part of this. So please do become a sustainer at patreon.com/DannyHaiFong or Substack or wherever you choose. That is, all of those possibilities are in the link in the description of this video. But with that said, I do want to talk about, so this Thursday I am speaking, and this is part of the reason I can't do a call-in tonight. I am needing to pick up my dog, and then I'm getting ready to go out of town just to upstate with my wife at this cabin that her family has. Going to stay there, and the technology may be a little dicey, but nonetheless, I'm still going to be speaking at this event for the Canadian Foreign Policy Institute. Don't have the information yet to share, but do keep a lookout on all places where you can follow me. Twitter, you can find that all. Telegram, the Haifong Press, Patreon, if you are a subscriber, Twitter at Spirit of Ho. Do keep a lookout for the details of that event. But I'm going to be talking about the NATO summit because that's coming up. That is coming up very soon. It is starting, I believe it is starting, what, middle of the week, I believe. There's a lot of protests happening already in Madrid, yep, the 28th to the 30th. So, you know, I'm going to be speaking on the makings of an Asian NATO, okay? Asian NATO. So, and I'm going to talk about Taiwan in particular because everything that we talked about with Richard Wolff is so relevant here. And this is a very critical topic. I mean, just this past, I think the last 24 hours, right, the G7 committed something like $600 billion to counter the Belt and Road Initiative. It's going to push that as they plan to meet. They're going to try to compete with China's infrastructure development. And so there is an active, as I said, and as we were talking about, there is an active effort on the part of the United States and its European allies and Japan and some others who they're trying to bring in the Pacific to form a block that can counter China. And I mean, the same is happening against Russia. So there is really two fronts of war, right? Major war happening on the economic realm. And of course, the military encirclement is even more dangerous in many respects. And the reason why that is because this $600 billion investment, I mean, we're talking about seven countries, the United States being the biggest economy out of those, you know, in the group. You're talking about a group of imperialist countries that are all bark and no bite when it comes to economic development. The United States can't be expected, as given all of the conditions we just spoke about, right? Rising inflation, a coming recession, a quagmire, right, in Ukraine, where it's just pumping more and more and more military assistance, weaponry, et cetera, into Ukraine. The sanctions, economic warfare toward Russia, which ripple across the world. All of those factors get in the way of the United States, even if there was an interest, get in the way of the United States investing. The United States doesn't want to invest right now. Anytime you're talking about a recession, you're talking about de-investment, disinvestment. You're talking about more austerity and more pain, of course, for working class people. But really, you're talking about putting the economic system into a world of pain. And so all of this is bluster, but the bluster does have substance to it. And so the G7, right, they're going to talk about countering on the economic realm and technology, and they're going to talk about, they're going to talk a little bit about military and, you know, military endeavors, foreign policy endeavors. But really, the crux of that is going to happen in the NATO summit. So some of you may not know that earlier in 2021, NATO released something called its 2030 initiative, the NATO 2030 initiative. And this initiative is a complement to the economic warfare side. The NATO 2030 initiative is a comprehensive so-called agenda that will address all the various quote-unquote threats to the security of NATO. And what are these threats? Well, the two biggest, right, are Russia and China. And of course, they name other things just for public relations purposes, pandemic, climate change, cyber warfare, which generally includes Russia and China. But the crux of the matter is that Russia and China are the big targets here. And what's interesting in this NATO 2030 initiative is that China is talked about almost as kind of like the end game. It's talked about as, well, China is what needs to be addressed if NATO is going to sustain and lead a rules-based international order. And this means confronting China on all realms, militarily, economically, technologically, you know, all across the board. And so NATO is looking at the Pacific now. But what's interesting about NATO looking at the Pacific is that at the same time you have the United States, which NATO is just a reflection. It's just a reflection of U.S. foreign policy objectives. NATO, as Richard Wolff said, I find it funny, not really a thing. No, it's the United States' military alliance in the Atlantic, the so-called North Atlantic Treaty Organization. It is the military alliance that the United States leads to kind of lead Europe around in its imperialist ventures. And Turkey, I guess, is in there too, and some other countries, but it's mainly a European institution. And so this whole idea of a NATO in the Pacific or an Asian NATO has actually been rejected verbally, right? Nobody wants to say it. Nobody wants to say, right? Lloyd Austin was at the Shangri-La dialogue. And even though he spoke in very hostile, aggressive terms against China, China is a threat, China is doing this, China and Taiwan, we got to defend Taiwan, you know. Even though he spoke like that, he actually rejected the idea of an Asian NATO. So you have the U.S. empire speaking out of two sides of its mouth in relation to this Asian NATO concept, but you actually have in all of its actions the development of what I would say a rudimentary Asian NATO or a Pacific NATO, in the sense that you have at the NATO summit, right, four Pacific-based countries invited. You had Japan, South Korea, New Zealand, and I believe Australia. That was invited to the NATO summit, Japan and South Korea being the two most controversial, given that these are countries that are right on the doorstep of China. And these countries, right, they're already participating in alliances that are supposed to mirror a kind of NATO-like infrastructure. However, this is what's interesting, is that the rhetoric around these institutions is more delicate. So, for example, the Quad, the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue, it is not even promoted as a military alliance. No, 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 no. You'll never have India. You'll never have Japan. You'll never have even Australia, although Australia is more than willing to thump its chest at China. You'll never have them say, no, this is a military alliance. Now, the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue is supposed to be a broad alliance in order to share so-called common interests. And it's all about combating China. But then you had AUKUS in 2021 form. The Biden administration spearheaded AUKUS, the Australia, UK, and US military alliance. This is a military alliance through and through. It is all about the US and the UK dumping its military hardware onto Australia, building nuclear submarines decades from now. It's all about getting Australia to raise its defense expenditures so that it can be a useful pawn in this new Cold War against China. Now, let's enter Japan, right? So this is the NATO-like infrastructure we're talking about. Japan recently, Shinzo Abe, the former prime minister, thoroughly discredited at this point, but nonetheless influential. He just, within the last week, made a comment saying that he believes that the U.S. and its allies, including Japan, need to stop China from seizing Taiwan now. They need to prevent it from doing it right now, even when it's not happening. Essentially saying it's time to confront China with a heavy hand. So Japan is saying that. And for some context, Japan has more than 100 U.S. military bases, deep military partnership with the United States, and the new government, which is, God forbid, do I even say that it's more right-wing than Shinzo Abe? But it is, and it's already committed to increasing its own military expenditures in order to combat China, right? So Japan is getting in right at the cusp of Japan's participation in the NATO summit on this question of Taiwan, essentially saying, and this is ironic from Japan, given that for more than five decades colonized Taiwan, massacring untold numbers of people and creating an untenable political situation on the island. But nonetheless, Japan is getting involved heavily, right? So it's a dangerous situation, but it is very NATO-like. And the reason I want to talk about Taiwan in relation to this idea of a Pacific NATO is because I would say that Taiwan is the most important flashpoint for any kind of military alliance for the United States to develop. So what I mean is that Taiwan is the center of the military encirclement of China. Taiwan is where the United States would like to provoke a conflict if such a conflict were to occur. You've seen the Meet the Press, you've seen the Center for New American Security, CNES, these Pentagon, State Department, military industrial complex funded think tanks. You've seen them talk about the prospect for war, right? You've seen them talk about the prospect for war with China. It's always with about Taiwan. They're not saying, oh, it's about South Korea or Japan or it's about the Philippines. No. It's about the South China Sea. You don't even hear them talking about a possible confrontation in the South China Sea, even though that is also likely, given that the U.S. continues to send warships over and over and over again, continues to just throw its hand in the face of China and the world, saying, no, we're not going to follow any rules, even though we claim that we're all about freedom of navigation, but we're not going to participate in any rule-making body or process that can work out the South China Sea issue. So it's all about Taiwan. And even just recently, as we move into the NATO summit, Biden has agreed to $120 million more dollars, U.S. dollars worth of assistance to Taiwan's so-called Navy. And this is the fourth time that Biden has approved of military expenditures to Taiwan, military arms transfers. And as I said in a past stream, that only is going to continue to rise or increase the number of the backlog, this massive backlog of about $14 billion so far, but that's only going to go up after the Biden administration. A backlog of $14 billion worth of military weapons transfers to Taiwan that exists prior to the Biden administration. It's only going to go up. It's the fourth time that the Biden administration has approved such a thing. And this comes in the wake of the Biden administration three different times, including most recently within the last month, saying that the United States has a commitment to intervene in Taiwan should China invade. Now, all of this, the increasing military expenditures to Taiwan, the open threats to military intervention should China invade, all of this is a violation of all the joint communiques, all of the One China policy documents agreed upon during the normalization process. It's a violation of the United Nations Charter. It's a violation of the fact that the United Nations recognizes Taiwan as part of China. It's a violation of both international law and as well as the agreements between the U.S. and China. So much so that there are some who will say, well, yeah, there's strategic ambiguity, and the United States actually says that it believes Taiwan is part of China and the One China policy, but then follows the Taiwan Relations Act, which says it has the right to continue to give arms to Taiwan in its defense. Now, while that may be true on paper, there's also another document, 1982 Joint Communique, which says literally, word for word, I mean, this is a paraphrase, but word for word, this is what it says, that the United States will commit to reducing arms transfers to Taiwan in each and every successive transfer, meaning that you are moving toward zero military arms transfers, military assistance to Taiwan. That was what was agreed upon. Not, we're going to do this forever and we're going to increase it until there's a war. That was not the agreement. And so the United States is playing a very dangerous game here. And the only way for this dangerous new Cold War with China to succeed, if it can succeed, which I don't believe it can, because I don't think, and I'm going to get to this to close, but I don't think it can succeed. There's no success here that can be driven. As we were both saying, Richard Wolff and I, and as Richard Wolff made very clear, the United States is not really in the position to succeed. It's going to lose in Ukraine. It's going to lose this new Cold War as well. It's going to lose it. And the only way it can hope, right? The only way it could hope for any of the success that it wants, which is containment of China, which is a euphemism for regime change and destabilization. The only way it can hope for that is through military alliances, is through these so-called alliances that Biden always talks about. That's why there's a NATO-like infrastructure, Pacific NATO-like infrastructure being thought about, is because it's not that the United States wants this, that this is like, this is just a choice. This is just hubris. Oh, yes, let's, no, it needs these alliances. It needs them, because without the kind of support that the United States sees in Europe with regard to Russia, without that kind of support in Asia and the Asia Pacific, the United States cannot even hope to pull the trigger on Taiwan. And there are strategists, there are militarists, there are neocons that want to do that. Now, I don't know exactly where Biden sits there. I think it's somewhere on both sides. And he'll go with whichever wind will push the hardest, if you catch my drift. So with that said, what we are looking at is an attempt to build robust relationships in the region to build up to a certain point in the U.S.-China relationship where the United States, even if it doesn't want to get into this, what would be earth-shattering, potentially humanity-ending war with China, it wants the option. And the only way you can have the option is if there's some kind of Pacific NATO infrastructure. It's not going to be a Pacific NATO, and this is where we can move into, and I'll just close with this before I get into any comments, questions. But the only way, right, this can work, to build up to have it as an option, is for these relationships to be robust. But it won't work. And why won't it work? Well, usually this is how things are talked about in foreign policy establishment circles, think tanks, the political class, the Pentagon. They don't talk about China as, sometimes the Secretary of State, sometimes the State Department will, but they don't talk about China as being anything but an aggressive force. But the problem with that framing of China is that, one, it's fundamentally untrue, and two, it negates the reality of the situation, which is China has prestige in the Asia Pacific. One would wonder why. Well, China's in the Asia Pacific. China is in the region. And it's also the biggest economy in the world in PPP terms, second GDP terms. It's growing. It has a lot to offer. A lot of its growth actually is hinged upon partnerships with even adversaries, or so-called adversaries like Japan. Japan sees China very adversarially, but nonetheless, Japan played a huge role in China's economic development over the last 40 years through economic partnership. China is the leader of these massive trade deals like the RCEP. China is a leader of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and its Belt and Road Initiative is something that no country in that region that has any interest of with stability and prosperity would pass up an opportunity to participate in that. And even if they do pass it up, they're not going to pass up opportunities to trade bilaterally with China. That would be economic suicide. So the United States is in a bind because it can't replace that. It cannot replace that investment that China can offer. It can't replace that infrastructure development that China can offer. And it also can't replace, and people will hate me to say this, it can't replace the good neighborliness, the mutual cooperation. It can't replace what that does. Funny story, my wife is a nurse and she works out here in the city. Her preceptor, who's teaching her how to do things, she's from the Philippines. And she said to my wife, she was like, what do you think of China? You know, they were talking about China. And she was just like, you know, I go back to the Philippines and all I got to say is that China is building all the roads, the bridges, the infrastructure. Can't complain about that. So this is the feeling, right? I mean, this is going to be the feeling in that region toward China. No matter how much the United States tries to use its puppets, and we do now have a puppet situation in South Korea, right, with the new right-wing government. Japan, very much the case. Australia, forget about it. Australia is shooting itself in the foot with the way that it's handling this bilateral relationship with China. This whole decoupling, it's a ridiculous notion given that exports, imports for Australia are by far reliant and hinged upon China. That's its biggest partner on both sides. So this is why it won't work, because none of these countries can afford for it to work, even if the United States has a gun to their head and says, do it or else. It's not going to work, because it'll collapse these societies, and these societies cannot collapse one by one because the United States needs them to be in alliance with them. You can't have collapsing societies. It's almost like if we asked Libya to be a major partner of the United States in Africa against whatever, Chinese investment. It's ridiculous to even think about that, because Libya is in complete a catastrophe. The United States destabilized that government and never recovered. It never recovered. Now, that's not going to happen militarily to these partners, but an economic catastrophe for these Asian countries, right, decoupling from China, would surely create a very similar scenario, a level of instability that would actually run counter to U.S. interests, right? You need a stable government in these countries to have a stable orientation toward China, but it's not going to work. $600 billion to counter the Belt and Road Initiative, which is worth trillions of public U.S. dollars, trillions of dollars spent by China alone. This is not even account the investment that's made by the governments themselves in joint partnership with China. I mean, it's not going to make a dent. It's not going to make a dent. Because where does, unlike China, and this is a huge difference, and I'm going to close on this, unlike China, which has the mutual cooperation piece, the commitment to peace, around Taiwan, right, China says our red line is what the United States is saying, military intervention for separatism and independence. But on all other counts, China's like, we're going to peacefully resolve this with Taiwan. We're going to have reunification on a peaceful basis. There's no smoking gun there. But with the infrastructure, right, there's something very fundamental about this. China uses a lot of private companies in infrastructure development abroad, no doubt. But the financing is state-oriented. The Exim Bank, Export-Import Bank, state-owned. A lot of the construction that happens, a lot of that is state-owned, right? You have a lot of state-owned investment as well in the Belt and Road Initiative. So it's a lot of public dollars that is government-oriented, that can be directed in the right places when these projects are successful. The United States has no such infrastructure, nor do its European partners at this point. So it's all going to go to these investors that are going to blow it. That's what they've been doing for how long? They don't want to spend money. They're already talking about tanking the economy. So if you have $600 billion floating, it's going to go to all sorts of contractors, banks, etc., and they're just going to blow it. They're not going to build bridges and roads. They're not going to build ports. They're not going to build stadiums. They're not going to build hospitals and schools. China's building 1,000 schools in Iraq. The United States can't build one. And that's because they'll hand it to private interests, capitalist interests. And what do they do with it? They gamble it, usually. They gamble it. They try to flip it They try to get more from it. They try, or they just pocket it. I mean, that's what happens. Like what happened in Haiti. A lot of dollars went to the Red Cross, this private slush fund, basically, this humanitarian, so-called humanitarian organization. They pocketed a lot of the money, a lot of the donations, a lot of the sponsorship. They just pocket it. They don't build anything. They don't build hotels. They don't build makeshift shelter during the earthquake that happened in the Obama era. I mean, that's what's going to happen with the $600 billion. So there is no competition with China, Richard Wolff said. No competition. There's no competition because the United States doesn't have the same priorities or the same interests. So there we have it. There we are. The United States is going to lose the new Cold War, and it's hinging its hope that it can build up alliances toward a hot war should that scenario be required. It's like the end game scenario. But the United States is basically placing all of its bets on that. Because $600 billion on infrastructure, all of this stuff, it's a drop in the bucket when you consider who's actually going to be handling this money and how it is handled. So I just want to talk about the NATO summit because that's what's very significant about it. And we're going to see more provocations and we can expect this trajectory to continue. But on the bright side, we can expect China and its allies, including Russia, to play a stabilizing force. And so we have to pay attention to that and be ready to counter all the propaganda that comes with placing attention on that and making sure that people understand, because we have a really illiterate society right now. American exceptionalism is on high, and there's a lot of just focus. There's a lot of focus on these very narrow things right now. And the ruling class is putting us in that position, right? We have to fight about abortion rights, something so basic. Something so basic, but we're fighting over it because of this historic trend. The United States loves this. It's the most extreme society when it comes to these kind of issues. It's built on the most extreme form of private property and capitalist accumulation. So we have to focus on this. It's absolutely ridiculous, but here we are. We do have to keep the picture big, though, because abortion rights are intimately connected to all of this. You can't have abortion rights in a society that's willing to bomb women, bomb children, and basically destroy the livelihoods of people around the world. You know, just like you can't have Black liberation or any kind of liberation for indigenous people if you have a society that's willing to massacre and commit genocide against the very same people in Africa, Latin America, etc. That you can't have it, right? You can't have nice things in an imperialist society, and especially an imperialist society that's in decay. And so it's the chicken or the egg, but really we know the roots are based in how this society developed from the very beginning and how its political economy developed from the very beginning. And we know now we're seeing the consequences of that bear fruit in this like age of decadence and this age of decline. But nonetheless, I have about a few minutes left. Be sure to keep liking the stream. You know, it definitely helps boost this algorithm. Keep sharing it. Be sure to subscribe if you haven't. Hit the notifications bell so you get notifications. And yes, somebody said, Lauren, thank you for the congratulations. Just $21, $22. You could say $22 because Patreon is ridiculous at calculating money and taking fees. But I am just that amount away from my goal for the year. Now, it's the end of the month, and so things happen, people leave, so I'm likely farther away in retrospect come July 1st, but nonetheless, please do support me. That's how you sustain this work, and it's very much appreciated. But nonetheless, that's what I have, guys. That's what I have. I don't think there's any questions here. I didn't see any. I'm going to thank some super chats, though, before I go. Thank you so much, Elisa, for the super sticker. I really appreciate that. I think there was at least one more super chat somewhere here while we were speaking. Really do appreciate that kind of support. You know, it's tough times. Everything we were talking about today signal tough times. Thank you, Kyle, and good for this comment. Nixon froze wages 6 months before he froze prices. That's capitalism, baby. It's all about hitting the worker, right? It's all about exploiting workers for profit. Thank you, Juliet. I hope to see you again sometime soon. I know I've caught you at events out here. So thank you for coming through, and thank you for the super chat. So yeah, it looks like that was it for the super chats. This was a great discussion with Richard Wolf. So glad to have got him here. But I do have to go. This was great. Again, no Colin today. It's very regrettable. I'll have to make up more at some point because it is that kind of commitment. But it was great to be with all of you. Now, for streaming, I have this event on Thursday. I have work. You know, I'm going to be – it's going to take some working out because I'm going to be out there until after July 4th. But I'll try, especially during when my wife is out at work, when I'm out there. I'm going to try to get on again, probably solo. So keep a lookout for that. I may not have this set up, though. So apologies if you don't like to see all of this. I don't know, all the little fine details that this camera provides. But it may just be my laptop cam. I'll bring my mic and stuff so it'll still sound good. But it may not look as nice. So apologies for that. Don't let it scare you away. But nonetheless, keep a lookout. I'll try to stream one more time before July 4th and then, you know, move forward with some other ideas. All right. So Deborah on Facebook says, where is the super chat? So that's a YouTube thing, Deborah. So Deborah Souza Oliveira, I don't think you can give super chats on Facebook. Head over to YouTube on the left lens. You don't have to give me a super chat. If you can, subscribe to my Patreon or even give a one-time annual donation on Substack. That works too. But you can find all that on YouTube. So come to YouTube, Deborah, to the left lens. You can like it. You can also send a super thanks, I think, on the video. That's a new thing. So however you want to help, that's really appreciated. But Facebook doesn't allow you to do any of that. And one day when I actually get the energy to make the transition from to Rockfin and Rumble, which is going to happen, I think, very soon. You can, I'll be streaming from there. So thanks, Deborah, for that question. But nonetheless, all right, guys, take care, everyone. This was a great show. I'll be back with you. I'll make sure to inform you, notify you. Be sure, I always share my Telegram. I don't know if you guys have been paying attention to my Telegram, but make sure you're following me there. All right, there it is in the chat one more time. And this was great. Like it before you go. So if you haven't liked the stream yet, like it before you go. Hit the notifications bell, of course, subscribe to the channel. And then last time, patreon.com/DannyHaiFong. That's how you help sustain this work. I'm very close, $20 or so left from my goal. Appreciate all of you, all of my subscribers, all of the viewers who cannot subscribe, everyone who supports my work in whatever way they can. Really appreciate it. Take good care, everyone. Peace out. And I'll see you again soon.